broken it. There we go.
Yeah, I'm fine.
How's that?
That's perfect.
Okay. Well, this kind of started off. Originally, I was thinking about making a film from this, and I thought it'd make a great film, but it's going to cost loads of money. And it was all kind of going really well, and then I made a film called Kung Fu Flid, and that kind of ruined things. Really, it's about a guy with no arms who does kung fu. No, really, it is. It was financed by these gangsters as well. It's kind of ruined my film career. So I'm working on it as a novel. And really, it's about a father's relationship with his son, and it ends up, it follows each of his birthdays. And it's all very tragic. It ends up in a big war, and a father follows his son into a war. And this is kind of the beginning of the novel. And particularly after the last bit, which was really funny, I'm going to leave you all really depressed, I'm afraid. Sorry about that. Someone said to me, I really should write something happy, but I can't. I've got a really happy life, generally, but and I sort of feel I need to inject some misery into the world. So here we go. This is an extract from a thing that I'm writing called The Boy. The coins were sitting on the side of the worn sideboard in a small room in which he was alone, his ear to the door of the bedroom. He could feel his wife's body fight and twist and scream. He became rigid as he heard the doctor shout orders to the nurse. He clenched his fist, pushed himself away and began to pace. The nurse opened the door and called for hot water. Wiping her eyes clean of sweat and blood, she saw his tremble and reached out to him with her hand. And for a moment they steadied each other before a cry stole her back. He snatched the large black kettle from the hearth, dashed down the two flights of stairs to the pump which stood outside in the courtyard behind the tenement, thrashed it until he had filled the kettle with water before running back up. And it was no coal or wood with which to set a fire, you know, and his hand clawed his brow as his eyes searched the room. And the screams, they were coming quicker now. He put the kettle in its place, searched for his small axe, took it to the table and the two wooden chairs on which they had imagined themselves to be kings and queens. And with each attack of the axe, it was like he was sacrificing those memories to save her. And there was no paper other than her Bible with which to set the kindling. This book had survived three generations. He took the pages from the middle, scrunched them into balls, placed them into the grate, took the kindling he had hacked from the chairs, built a pyramid on which he had added the two thick legs of the dining table. Now he didn't notice that the screaming from within the room had ceased as he reached from the hearth to the sideboard to retrieve the matches from the drawer, and his hands fumbled with the box, opening it the wrong way, and the entire contents fell onto the floor. He snatched a match, struck it, and gave the flame to his workings. It flicked and fought, the flame hungry for life, clinging on, frantic, like it would drown if it could not keep hold. And he looked into its heart and saw the life of the child fighting with the womb that was trying to banish him. It was pushing at the walls, tearing with its fingers, its toothless mouth biting and clinging on. And in the background, it was silent, in a vacuum in which both life and death lingered, and into that silence the child screamed. He turned slowly from the flames towards the door, and for a long time nothing happened. And when the door opened, it was the nurse who was standing there, pulling her hairline, and in her arms she held the child. It was wrapped in the swaddling that his wife had so lovingly prepared. "It's a boy, Will," the nurse said quietly. "He's a beauty." He stood slowly, crossed over to look on his son for the very first time. She held the babe out for him, and he took the child awkwardly. And now the boy felt fragile in his arms, his little limbs soft and weak, his hands out of proportion to the rest of him, the white map in his palms as clear as the heavenly constellations. As he held him, he watched in wonder as the little boy began to move, random jibes in the air, his legs winding under the swaddling as if weaving muscle together, his face and eyes in shudder reaction, little inert recitations of labor, the mechanics and the makings of manhood. And tiring, his body grew still, and Will lifted him to his lips and kissed his little face, careful not to rub the boy's new skin with the coarseness of his own unshaven jaw. He felt the boy's hand run along his cheek, his spider-legged fingers hook into his bottom lip, the tips touching his tongue before searching up, poking into his nose and then journeying his eyes. The boy's own eyes like cerulean sears, dark, rich, royal blues into beaming, enlightened gems. His face was wrinkled and wide, and what the father saw was the mirror of himself and her, not in the beginning of life, but at the end, when all that is to be learned is past and done. And then finally, he looked up and he saw her lying still on their marriage bed. You know, her face was pale, the edges around her eyes were red, and her lips were a bisque yellow with pink rims, deflated by the exhaustion of the end. And the doctor was standing in the corner of the room, cleaning his hands on a cloth. Now, he looked tired and weathered, like he'd been battling a god. He was wearing a waistcoat over his white blood-stained shirt with his sleeves rolled up. "I'm sorry, Will," he said. "I tried everything I could." Now, Will nodded and said nothing. He crossed over to the sideboard. He paused for a moment before picking up the coins that she had placed there the week before. "I can't take this, Will. Please, she wanted you to have it. We pay our way." The doctor looked at the chopped up bits of furniture. "I have some saved," said Will. "I have." "No, Will, I won't take it." And Will's head dropped and they watched his silence. "You must take my money, doctor," he said, reaching for the doctor's hands and placing the coins in his palm. "I don't want no pauper's grave for her." Will's teeth were gritted. The priest had comfortable furrows in his forehead. "It'll be no pauper's grave, Will," he said. "I don't want her lying on someone else or someone pressing down on her because there's now anywhere else because I can't pay premium." "She needs a proper burial, lad," he said. "It's what she would have wanted." Will's face was tight with anger. "She wanted to live. That's what she would have wanted." "I can understand your anger, Will." "I'm not angry. I'm brokenhearted. The only thing she wanted of this life was to raise this boy and to hold him to her heart and call him by his name. She wanted nothing more. No riches, no gold, no life on a high wire. She wanted none of that. And all I wanted was to watch her do just that. She's no longer yours, Will. Her body belongs to a maker." "No, priest. She made me, and I made her." The priest lowered his eyes to the floor. "Well, can I at least say some words over her?" "Aye, go on. I won't deny thee that." "And the boy, will you allow the boy to pray?" "He's a babe. He knows not your incantations and superstitions. They're meaningless to him. He's unlearnt in the manner of your ways, and that's how he shall remain." "You do him an injustice," said the priest, "if you shield him from the Lord's mercy." "Well, he hasn't had much of that, has he, priest? Having been born from a dead pauper's womb." And the priest was overcome and lost for words. He walked to the door and he looked upon her form upon the bed. "But how are you going to bury her, lad?" he asked, "eh? How are you going to bury her?" And he sat in the bare room in the cold half dark with the boy in his arms. The room smelt of blood and death and sweat and urine. He was waiting for some change to come, as if waiting for the river man to ferry her back, return what he'd stolen. He seemed small on that riverbank, dwarfed by it. And our time trickled on. He placed the boy in his cot He lifted the bucket of hot water, carried it back into the bedroom and placed it beside the bed. He pulled back the sheet that covered her body. Her clothes were stained with blood and horror. He gently took the nightdress off her until she lay there naked, like a virgin, her arms coyly over her breasts, her body frigid in the shame of death. He reached into the bucket, scooped up some water and began to wash her. He washed her tenderly, reclaiming her body for himself. He rested his hand on her pelvis, the edge of it against the dark pubic hair. He bent down and rested his head there. The water had warmed her belly, and for a while he imagined that she was alive and that he was back into the living of her. And raising himself up, he washed her face. And when he was finished, he kissed her softly on the lips and told her that he loved her. He lifted her gently and removed the sheet that was under her and let it fall to the floor, and went to the chest and found the embroidered sheet that had greeted them on their wedding night. He unfolded it, and as carefully as he could, he passed it under her body before wrapping her in it, cocooning her. And for a moment, he stood over the shell of her. He walked out of the bedroom to the cot, knelt and picked the boy up. You know, he felt as light and seemed to float in his arms. He carried him out of the room across the hall, knocked on the door there, and a woman answered. He handed her the boy and said, "I'll be back in morning. You take as long as you need, Will. It ain't no bother." He carried her body into the street, putting her on the bedroom door that he'd already placed there, and then wrapped the rope in a lattice pattern to secure her. The families of the tenement block were watching him as he reached for the tools, the pickaxe and the spade that he'd borrowed from a neighbour, and tied them to the side of the door, mindful that they should not touch her. He took a piece of rope and threaded holes that he'd carved earlier and tied it into a circle and slung it over his shoulder, and took the weight of the door and his dead wife. As he walked, figures appeared in the doorways. Men removed their caps and bowed their heads. The autumn wind ran like banshees through the windows and alleys and gusts that swirled around them, stinging his ears. And time was weary and their pace detached and slow. The tenements gave way to terraces which stood hunched and heartbroken, their inhabitants lining the streets, some with candles in their hands. Women ran out and placed flowers on the rope work as he passed. And his walk was somber and his gaze ahead. He did not slack or quicken his pace, maintaining the resolute requiem to his gait, his eyes to the front, to the hills, for if she is a ghost, that is where she will be, that is where. And the night was mizzled and curtained with damp. The rope groaned and dug into his shoulder. The wood of the door chafed the road, bouncing on the uneven surface, snapping his bondage-like reins. The bossage, the bosket, and the briar cracked under the weight of the black mass of the night, the stars hidden behind a thick moss canopy of sweating clouds. His breath, which was frosted and sharp, vanished into the gloom that enclosed him. Her body bounced, the tools clunked on the side of the door in a mule pack melee, their vibration wounding him. Half a mile out of town, he turned left off the road to mount the hill, his feet slipping under the grass, the door tugging. The firm ground became soft and sucked his feet, forcing him to fight for each step. His thighs were aching, his hands were numb, his face white, his hair damp upon him, the sweat under his coat cold, making for his bones, his breath thicker and punch drunk as he struggled himself on, his head in stubborn concentration sinking from one side to the other. And he fell, his hands sinking into the freezing clay. His trousers were soaked, the rush surge clinging uncomfortably to his legs like cold skin. He pulled himself out of the mud as if he were Adam, forming out of clay. He stumbled, dropped, stood, fell, fought, his throat gasping, his lungs filling with the clag of the land. And he stopped for breath, resting his hands on his knees, his heart pounding in his chest, and his lungs inflating his veins with blood and oxygen, and then on again with a blind man's compass within him, up into the hill where the sludge transformed to rock, sodded by rough turfs of bracken. Thorns snagged and tore into his skin. They caught on her corpse, the devil's bracket. Little fingers trying to claim her for their own. But up he went, up, for that is where she had flown with arms outstretched, a shawl like lucent wings up into the clouds, when they had looked down on creation like runic gods. His feet struggled for grip on the elevation of the chalk, his hands grabbing for clumps of grass which came away, his feet scrabbling and then his hands grasping the grass held, and he lifted himself onwards foot after foot, and the ground became earthen once more, softer under his feet and more even. The clouds began to pull aside like theatrical curtains, revealing a clamour of diamonds in the headdress of the moon, their brilliance silhouetting his last journey with her. And the walking was easier now. The sheer brute of his struggle gave way to relief and collapse as he arrived at their lover's retreat, a place of magisterial beauty where she had once turned to him smiling and said, "This is how a poor man is equal to all creation. This is how." And he'd smiled and they'd kissed and watched the day turn into night. Wood spat flared jewels from the flames, and all the world was theirs to keep. All the world. He lay there, removed his coat, took the pickaxe, and began to hack at the ground. The earth loosened. He swapped the axe for the shovel, cleared the mud and graveled rock, then once more took up the pick. He worked through the depth of the night, smashing through seams of rock. The dawn came and went, the sun rose and shone, and by early afternoon he was finished, and for a moment he rested. Hoisting himself out, exhausted and caked in mud, he crawled over to her, dragged her to the edge of the pit, and loosened the ropes that held her to the door. He undid the cloth from her face and looked upon her for the very last time, running his fingers through her hair. He leant forward and kissed her softly on the forehead, then her lips, and held his cheek to hers. And he was still for a long while, wishing her farewell, and with a final kiss he closed up her shroud. He eased himself back into the grave, took her into his arms, held her, and then lowered her gently so that she lay at his feet. He said no words, he uttered no prayers. He reached up from the mound of earth to the side of the pit and began to bury her slowly, never letting the rock or the sediment fall heavily upon her. He buried her as if he was burying his most precious treasure as a gift for the generations to come. And when he felt his work could damage her no more, he climbed out, shoveled the remaining earth to close up a grave and patted down the mound. And turning to look at their view, which stretched out into the distance, he sat on the damp grass as a breeze blew through his hair and billowed beneath his shirt, chilling the sweat on his skin. Below the rocks, the land was painted with musty lemons into lime, into harrowed greens, the slow animation of autumnal browns, oxidized reds, dry hay yellows into amber, cinnamon, deep mahogany, blushing auburn, wild moor into ploughed land through woods and farmyards, amid a crisscross of hedges and grey stone walling, segmenting the earth as far as he could see. And in the distance, he could see a bird of prey hanging over the earth, a buzzard or a falcon or a hawk, he could not tell which, for it was a faint horn of a shadow. And he thought about her in the landscape, her smile, her nose, the thick of her hair, her eyebrows, oh, her intelligent eyebrows, which were pointed instead of arched when she listened or spoke. He thought about the last times he'd had with her. He thought about her pregnant, a full belly that never seemed to weigh her down or distemper her in any fashion. Her smile as she stroked the bump, the distant look in her eyes as she contemplated the boy's movement. He remembered too her temper, you know, that once she'd thrown a wedding ring at him. He couldn't recall why or how the argument had finished, just remembered that she had. Mostly though, he remembered how she felt at night, with her head on his chest, the conversation petered out. As her breathing became heavy, her body would twitch with the last flickerings of the day. And always before him, always before, she settled still to sleep.